Proverbs 15:21. Folly delights a man who lacks judgment, but a man of understanding keeps a straight course. One of the things that you always hear in advice columns, you have to stop and smell the flowers. You have to take delight in life. And I think that's certainly true, because you can be so focused that you might miss out on family and that kind of things. But a lot of the people who say those kind of things are so busy smelling the flowers that they never get anything else done. And they can identify the flowers on the road, but they can't tell you where the road goes. And this proverb is sort of a bit of a challenge to that kind of thinking. Because if you delight in folly, that is helplessness, and there is nothing so helpless as somebody who knows a lot of stuff that nobody needs. But it's delightful. And they delight in it. And it leads to helplessness. If you have a job where you need to be able to do something and you know how to do something else, doesn't lead to anything. And finally we get, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline will drive it far from him. When we talk about child discipline, sometimes I think that the way it's talked about is a little short-sighted. Parents often will discipline their children simply to try to train them not to be annoying. And most of the discipline is, you know, you're making too much noise, you're playing too loudly, you're doing something that I don't like. And a parent who doesn't think about discipline in terms of what the scriptures say here, that what discipline is supposed to do is take the child who is helpless and discipline that child into a person who is capable. Now that's a completely different set of criteria and goals than my child won't go to sleep when I put him to bed. So what has happened is we have focused on this verse and the rod, the spanking, the paddle, the switch, instead of thinking about, well, what is it we're trying to do with this child? Because indeed, folly, or this helplessness, is bound up in the heart of a child. It came up this week in confirmation. And when you're dealing with 12, 13-year-olds, we were talking about honoring your parents, talking about being faithful to your spouse, not murdering, being a good citizen, not lying. And one of the youngsters said, well, where's the commandment about how parents are supposed to treat their children? Aren't they supposed to love us? And I go, well, we've covered all 10 of them. Do you see a commandment about what parents owe their children? No. And I said, well, what do you think that means? You mean I'm not the center of the universe? I go, well, not in God's point of view. But parents owe their children, according to the scriptures, and what God wants parents to do is to drive this folly out of them so that when they reach maturity, they are capable and not helpless. We have gotten away from that in our culture, and our children are paying a tremendous price for it because they're leaving home and then coming back home because they can't make it because they are still 25 years old and helpless. Because the parent disciplined the child based on what annoyed them instead of the purpose of discipline, which is to drive that folly out of them so that they are no longer helpless but capable of living their life, of doing the things that they need to do, and of living a good life and making their contribution. I was thinking about this when my oldest daughter was born. And I remember looking at her in her little bassinet there in the nursery at the hospital, and I saw this beautiful baby in the midst of all these ugly ones. And it occurred to me, I'm a father. What am I supposed to do with this child? And I sat there and I said, okay, my goal is that when she is 12, she will be able to gather information, make decisions, and accept the fact that it was her decision and live with the consequences. I did not want her to be helpless. I wanted her to be capable. And it is amazing. She came home when she was 13. She said, I told all my girlfriends that I wasn't going to run with them anymore. She was already in the upper clique. And we said, why did you do that? And she said, well, all they do is look down their noses at other people. And I've simply decided I don't want to be that way, and I'm going to make other friends. And I said, you know what you're giving up? And she said, yes, I won't get invited to some of the parties that are the best ones. She says, but I won't be sitting around talking about the other girls and about how I don't like them or how deficient they are. And I was proud of her. And I was sort of proud of myself. That was her decision. She was not helpless. Knew there would be consequences. And she was willing to live with them. But I got to tell you, she got the rod a lot. Any questions? All right. We also learned from the scriptures that the helpless person seems unable to learn. From Proverbs 24:7, we have, wisdom is too high for a fool. In the assembly at the gate, he has nothing to say. I think we've all know people who have all kinds of ideas, and they just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk until it gets to be decision time, and you have to go and you have to make your point at the city council meeting. Because the gate in the Old Testament is where the city elders met, and that's where decisions were made. And here is this helpless person who can go to the bar and everybody will listen to him, who can go to coffee and everyone will listen to him or put up with him or her. But when they get to the meeting where the real decisions are made, they have nothing to say because they are helpless in putting together an argument. They simply know how to call people names or get loud or get indignant, and they learn really quickly that that doesn't get them anywhere. They are helpless in the face of real decision making. That's what this verse says. Proverbs 1:7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools, that is these helpless, despise wisdom and discipline. I remember when I was in seminary, and I didn't like the process very much. I hated the process. And yet I had some emotional, psychological kind of problems and stuff left over from Vietnam. And I remember I was at a candidacy committee meeting, and here's 9 or 10 people who have the future of my life in their hands. And it was an unofficial meeting, and they just wanted me to drop by, so I did. And they said, well, why don't you tell me what you think of the process? I said, I don't think you want me to tell you what I think of the process. They said, oh, yes, we do. Now, see, I wasn't wise. Because a wise person would have understood, keep your mouth shut. They're just trying to bait you. Well, I let them have it. It was very foolish. And I knew that I had made a big mistake when I left the room. And boy, it wasn't 24 hours before I got that phone call. We think you need some counseling. Now, you've got a couple of choices when this happens. You can say, I'm doing just fine, thank you very much. And if you don't like me the way I am, I will just go somewhere else. Which I was very tempted to do. But I calmed down and I talked to some of my friends, and they said, just go ahead and do it. So I went and talked to one of the members of the committee, and I said, I know something went wrong, but I can't figure out what it was. Well, he didn't want to tell me for about 45 minutes. I think he knew I was the kind of person that was a little hard to talk to. And finally he said, well, I think this and this and this. And I think he thought I was going to come after him like I'd come after the committee. And I thought, no, okay, I've got some work to do. And I went to my counselor and met with the counselor every week for 8 months to try to deal with these things. Didn't want to. It was very, very unpleasant. But I was really angry. And it took almost 6.5 months before counselor and I got to it. When I was a helicopter door gunner in Vietnam, we had gone out late one evening to kind of look around to a place we were going to go the next day. And we had flown back to our base camp, and early in the morning we had gotten some troops, and we were taking them out to this place that we had looked at the night before. And we were scared. I mean, we were really, really scared because it was a bad place. So our gunships and all of us door gunners, we wanted to keep everybody's head down in that place so we wouldn't get shot. So the colonel whose battalion we were working with, we asked him, we said, is there any reason why we can't go in here and shoot this place up and keep people's heads down while we get in and get out? And this colonel said, no, I don't think so. So gunships are coming in and we're hitting the tree line and rockets are going off. Miniguns are firing. I had my M60 machine gun and I was fired about 400 rounds. And we get this scream over the radio. Cease fire, stop. So we haven't even landed yet. Cease fire, stop. So we all stopped. We're scared. Stopped, dropped our troops off, and we pulled out. And our commander said, this battalion commander forgot that last night he dropped a company of his battalion into this same place last night. We just killed 11 of our own people. So a few of us kind of went back around and we picked up the dead and the wounded and we took them back to a hospital. We got back to camp that night. It was the quietest night I'd ever spent in my life. Nobody talked. It was the worst day of my life. Absolutely the worst day of my life. I wanted to tear that colonel to pieces. I was so angry at him. But when you're a lowly enlisted man, you don't get to do that. I thought about the families of those young men, same age as me, and I had blocked it out of my memory, just blocked it out. Sometimes we need people to tell us, and we need to hear them tell us. Take that correction, because it was very, very important for my counselor and I to get there. That was about the second worst day of my life. It was so much pain. But I lost a lot of the anger that day. It was something that had to happen.